Okay, I will start. Hi, my name is Sven Frühsäcker. Thank you for coming to my speak. It's about local storage and cloud stack. I'm not sure, is anybody using local storage with cloud stack installation? Okay, so during presentation, I will not go too deep into technical stuff. But when you have questions or I have more slides after the thank you slide, maybe we can talk about that later. So I am a founder and CEO of a company called Pro.io based in Frankfurt, Germany. We're doing a lot of what we call remote hands. So we are working a lot in inside data centers for customers, taking care of their hardware. We are a German cloud provider. And we are also doing managed services on top of the cloud VMs. So before you make a decision if you want to use local storage in a cloud stack installation, you need to ask yourself first some questions. So do you also want your system VMs on local storage, or you will just leave them there on your shared storage? That's a question you need to ask. Then think about your SLA. Are you be able to fulfill your SLA to your customer when you use local storage? What do your customers really need? For example, we had the situation where a customer, and we started with software-defined storage. We started using Data Core. I'm not sure if you know Data Core. It's just a software layer for software-defined storage between your hypervisor and your storage systems, because the customer demand was, we need everything N plus one. And when we asked our customers with more detail, they answered, 99.95% availability will do it. And then we were thinking, okay, we don't need a duplicated storage to reach the 99.95% availability. You need to think about the management overhead you have with local storage. I will come to that at a later point again. Then the question is, which hypervisor you're using? The problem is KVM right now, as far as I know, is not supporting live storage migration in CloudStack. There is a PR open, but it's still not in the stable release. So if you're using a KVM as hypervisor, then don't use local storage. You need to create new compute offerings. You need to create new disk offerings. And the thing is, everything behind our decision to use local storage or to migrate everything from shared except system VMs, and we are still using, our system strengths are still running on shared storage. Our highest doctrine is keep it simple. It should be not more complicated as before. That doesn't make sense. IT is complicated enough nowadays, and when you just keep it simple, have the chance to do it, then do it. You need to enable the use of local storage inside the zone configuration. So you can, of course, run two different zones, even if they are the same data center, and you have a zone where local storage is not enabled and the other zone is just local storage, if you want. So this is our setup we started with. So we have the hypervisor level. Of course, it's really... I keep it just simple diagram here. So then we had the data core layer for the software-defined storage, and then we had the storage layer where all our storage hardware was in. And of course, we had several switches. We needed redundancy, so we had we're using Juniper hardware, so we had a virtual chassis over the switches. Of course, both switch levels can be the same physical switch, so you can just divide via VLAN, so it's no problem. But for to show to you in a better way, I just put two switch layers in it. And after we decided to go to local storage, we just erased everything under the hypervisor, which of course makes it really more simple for our administrators and for the network guys and all our stuff. So we saved the data core license, which is just a cost thing, the data core hardware, the infrastructure storage switches, and a lot of storage hardware, because we had everything two times for the redundancy. So the thing is, we keep it simple. It's just one layer after that. But of course, we run into several problems. A lot of you are using local storage, and I think you run in similar problems, maybe more. We are only using SenServer as a hypervisor. So what I can tell you from my experience is only SenServer based. So if you run into other problems, please tell us with other hypervisors. So we needed to find a way to migrate already installed instances from VMs. I'm using instances because CloudStack is calling them instances. To already installed instances from our shared storage to our local storage. And this is not really an easy way to go, because there's no working workflow inside the UI or via API. So you need to do database changes to do that. I will show you that later if you're interested in how we did it. Then we're coming to a big problem: data volumes. Local storage and data volumes are really complicated, because right now in SenServer, and I think, but this, I really think this is a CloudStack limitation, not a hypervisor limitation. Right now, you're unable to migrate data volumes which are not attached to an instance. So there is a situation where a customer just deployed the data volume, just untouched it because I don't use it anymore, and now you need to do some maintenance on the hypervisor. And during the downtime of the hypervisor, the data is not available because the storage is down. You're using local storage. So you only are able to migrate data volumes when they're attached to a volume, to an instance. That's really a problem. And when you think just a step further, for example, you have an instance running on hypervisor A, and you attach a data disk, and then you want to attach it to detach it, and you want to attach it to an instance running on hypervisor B. It's not possible, because the hypervisor B does not have access to the to local storage of the hypervisor A. So what a workaround for us is, you need to spin up a migration VM, attach it, migrate the VM to the another hypervisor, detach it, and then it will work. So we have some kind of scripts for that. Or we do it, our support will do it manually. So the thing is, this is everything you need to consider when you do a decision like using local storage. In our environment, data disks are not really common. So it's not really a big problem for us. We have our public cloud is just, I think the average VM is about 10 to 50 gigabytes of root disk, and that's it. So we do not have large root disk or large data disks. I think we have just 5% of our customers who are really using data disks. So the next thing is, we run into the problem of snapshots, leftovers of our storage. And we are using SSD storage as local storage, so it's not the cheapest storage, so you want to have as much as possible free for your customers. I think this was fixed in the latest version of CloudStack. We're also using Cloud Platform, which is now under the Accelerite banner, and we are also using CloudStack, so sometimes I will mix the versions. I'm not really sure which version is it in CloudStack when we run into the problem when it was at CloudStack, Cloud Platform. But we run into the, I think it was fixed in CloudStack 4.8 or 4.9. So what will happen when you do a volume snapshot? A volume snapshot will create a snapshot on the primary storage of the hypervisor when using SenServer, and it will stay on the local storage, even if it's, even after it has been transferred to the secondary storage. This is because the next snapshot will be just a delta of this. So SenServer is creating a chain, a snapshot chain. So the last snapshot will always stay on the primary storage. But when you, for example, the workflow is, you have instance A running on hypervisor A, you're doing a scheduled snapshot or whatever, volume snapshot, the hypervisor is creating a snapshot, and then you migrate the VM to hypervisor B, then the snapshot stayed on hypervisor A forever. There was no cleanup job or anything like that. So your expensive SSD local storage fills up with garbage. So you need to take care of that. Then we have the template situation, which is similar. So on local storage, of course, when you're using shared storage and you have a new template, the first time you install a virtual machine, this storage, the template will be copied from the secondary storage to the primary storage. And when you have shared storage, this is just one storage because it's shared, and all the hypervisors in the pool or in the cluster will just use that storage. But when you use local storage, of course you have every template on every local storage which was installed on this hypervisor. You need to be aware of that. So we updated our templates on a monthly basis to have it updated as updated as possible. But now we are doing quarterly, so we're not running into the problem that we have so many templates in our local storage. The thing is that there's one cleanup job, which will delete all templates which are not used anymore on this hypervisor. So even if you have the newest template on this hypervisor and every VM has been deleted using this template will be deleted on your local storage again, and the next time a customer's installing a VM from this template, it will copy it again. So you need, there's a little bit more time you need for that. So it's sometimes it just takes time for VM to create it successfully. Thing is, then we local storage over provisioning. I think there's a configuration parameter of that, but it was ignored in earlier versions. There was a bug. I think it's already been fixed in 4.8 CloudStack. So When you're using over provisioning on local storage, you need to be aware of that. So if you're using 4.7 or lower, it's a bug, and the over provisioning parameter will be ignored at all. Another problem we run into is there's no monitor implemented in SenServer to monitor your local storage when you're using thin provisioning. We are using thin provisioning. Because there's, from my perspective, there's no need that you, when a customer is buying 50 gigabytes of SSD, and actually we all know they are using just a small percentage of that. Why do we have to provide all the storage from the beginning? But you need to monitor your storage because you will just then run into the problem that maybe your whole SenServer stops working because the local storage is full and it's not working anymore. So we implemented a script, and we are monitoring our local storage via Nagios. We have a Nagios monitoring system, and we have a script, a cron. It's just a bash script, and you can download it on my blog site if you want. that will just alter the index.html of the send server. You know, when you have the management IP, you type in the management IP in the browser, you get the send server, have welcome to send server, blah, blah, blah page. And we alter this page, and Nagios will just will take a look at this page and we'll see if there's anything, the warning message, and then we will get informed that the storage is near 80% full and stuff like that. And then you need to, yeah, you need to migrate instances away from the send server. But this is, right now for us, it's a manually task we need to do. And of course, upgrades are more complicated when you use local storage, because you need to evacuate. Of course, you need to evacuate your hypervisor, which is, if you're using shared storage, it's the same, but it will take longer because you need to migrate the local storage away to other local storages. Are you running into other problems using local storage?
Yeah, with KVM, I saw some issues where we're using QCOW 2, which are thin provisioned images, and then admins tend to think that the hypervisor is not full, but over time the QCOW images start growing because okay. customers are writing data, and then suddenly after a year the hypervisor is full without adding any additional VMs, okay. but the QCOWs were growing. So you have to be quite conservative when you deploy your VMs. You'll see that disk utilization will start growing after a few months.
Okay.
It will grow gradually.
Yeah. We are using a script which will just migrate one instance after one after the other. So it really takes a long time. So I think we created pools out of 5 to 10 send servers, not more. We got into 5 now, but we started with 10, but now using 5 blocks, 5 cluster pool. Sometimes it really takes maybe a week to update this whole send server cluster, because we are waiting until the migration of one has been finished and then doing the other one. And the migration, I'm not sure, does KVM support live migration?
No, but we don't offer live migration.
Okay.
So we have
it's shut down.
We have a separate disk where the images are on, and a separate operating system disk, and we just shut down the images if we really need to do an upgrade, and we expect customers to run their application on a other VM.
Yeah, I will come to that later, yeah, okay. Okay. So, so this is what you need to consider when you're talking about using local storage. So what we use is, I need to say use because they are, I don't know why, but they are unavailable at the moment, is Samsung data center SSDs. Really good. The PM is more read and the SM is more write intense. We are using standard Dell PowerEdge servers. All our network are 10 gig. I think it needs to be at least 10 G to use storage live migration, because you need to move a lot of data from one hypervisor to the other hypervisor. We are using LACP trunks, so we have 2 times 10 gig per hypervisor for the management network and the front end for the VMs. Keep in mind that the storage live migration is using the management interface, so this is really important. And we're using a Juniper EX 4550 switches for in our installation as a virtual chassis, so we have a redundancy on the switch layer. So the thing is, what has the future? What is the future for us? So, there's a new release of Send Server 7.1, which is the LTS version of Send Server. And Citrix introduced the LTS version now. So there will be a live patching mechanism. I cannot talk about that because I didn't test it now until now. It's available only in the paid enterprise edition. I'm not sure we will able to using that in our cloud, because we are using the open source version of Send Server, unlicensed. It's the same version, but the unlicensed Send Server edition. Because really a big problem is the upgrades of the hypervisor. It's really this is the management overhead I was mentioned before at the beginning of this speak. It's really a lot. It is really a hard and long procedure to update all your hypervisors. So it's like painting the Golden Gate Bridge. When you're finished, you start at the beginning again. So keep that in mind. Storage life migration will be supported for KVM in the future. As I mentioned before, there is a request open. And I hope somebody... I'm not sure if there already is a merge... I think there's a merge request open, but I'm not sure it has been granted now. And data disk migration should be available in the future. I think Accelerite is on this, to be honest, and will I think they will contribute this to the community edition too. So just let's talk about the pros and cons, just for short. As I mentioned before, this is not really a tech, a deep tech thing. We saw 3 times faster IOPS with SSD local storage. I think you can have more, can have less, but of course I think local storage SSDs is really fast. SANServer has a limitation with the iSCSI stack, or iSCSI queue actually. We saved a lot of network infrastructure because we got rid of what I was showing you before. We got rid of 2 layers of infrastructure. We saved storage hardware and we kept it simple. The cons is no live migration of KVM. Of course, this is really a huge KO criteria. Data disk migration is also a problem. Unavailability data by host outage. That is a thing you need to consider. This is what I was talking about when I was talking about SLA. You need to be thinking about, are you able to provide the SLA you provide to your customer with local storage? What we are doing is we have a cold standby server. So we just, if there's a server fail down, if it's a malfunction or outage, we just unplug the hard drives and plug it into the cold standby, boot it up, and then the storage is accessible for the customer again. No high availability for VMs on the VM level, of course, because the local storage, that's where the storage is, so there cannot be high availability. So you need to talk to your customers and explain to them that they need to make their application high availability using load balancing or stuff like that. And you have the management overhead because of the time you need to migrate, to evacuate a hypervisor. We run into other problems I forgot to mention before. So the thing is that, but it's not really regarding local storage, but the problem is when you're using non-redundant routers, so just the standard routers, and your host is down, your hypervisor is down, it's really sometimes a problem that CloudStack is not recognizing that the host is down and he's not spinning up the virtual router on a different machine. We run into this problem after disabling our shared storage, so there must be some... I don't think it's a coincidence, but we didn't investigate this further. We're using redundant routers, we are on the safe side. The other problem is when you're using internal load balancer, I think there is no way to do it redundant. I'm not sure if you're using internal load balancers, and if so, is there a way to spin up a redundant load balancer? Okay, that's a problem you need to consider. That's it for now. Thank you for being here. So this is my blog URL when you want to take a look at the NIAS script we are using, or the bash script we are using to monitor local storage. Feel free, it's no problem. And yeah, you can follow me on Twitter. And thank you very much. If you're interested what we did to migrate from shared to local, feel free to ask. I can go through it if you want, if it's interesting for you. So what we did, you need to create new service offerings. Then you need to write down the internal name of your virtual machine, shut down, migrate the primary storage just via UI or API as you want, it's no problem, it's working. The thing is, when you do that, it will still have the label shared on it. It's still a shared storage in a database, and that's the huge problem. You cannot spin it up on local storage. CloudStack will tell you, I'm not able to spin up this virtual machine because it's on a different kind of storage. So what we needed to do is, we needed to do a DB change directly in the DB. I hate this to do that, but sometimes it's the only way to. I think you should. I know you know that. So so you need to get the ID of your service offerings you created earlier, and then you that is point 7. You update the VM instance set service offering ID, and the thing is, it's you need. Point 5 tells you, you need the disk offering, not the service offering. Sometimes you don't mix it up. We are talking about service offering, but in the DB of CloudStack, it's the disk offering ID we need to use. So please keep that in mind. And after that, after you updated the instance and the volume, you can just spin it up. So then it's working. And then you can do a live migration. Then it's also labeled local, and it's working without any problem. Yeah. The last thing is just this is explains the volume snapshot workflow we are run into the problem with filling up the local storage. So I do not say anything about that. Just if you want, you can take a look at that, or just ask me later if you want. I will stay here until the end.
How are you dealing with possible disk failures? Like, are you just plugging the disks, or are you creating like volumes using LVM or something?
Using a RAID. We're using a RAID 6. This is more marketing thing because we had a problem with RAID 5. Okay. We lost the whole host, and because some kind of our fault. So we asked Dell, which SSD can we use? I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Dell prices for SSDs, which are, I don't know, I can travel to the moon for one SSD, you know what I mean? And so we are not buying it through Dell. So we ask, okay, which SSDs are certified? And they told us the 850 Pro from Samsung, which is a consumer disk. So we used it, and the problem is that when the consumer disk is going into the into a suspend mode after a time, and the RAID controller of the Dell was not recognizing this and was just okay, it dropped out, and we had the situation where in 31 seconds two disks dropped out of the RAID 5, and so the RAID was destroyed, and so we needed to calm our customers down, and we told okay, we migrated everything to RAID 6. But we have a RAID level under it, and
so you are replicating the bits there.
Exactly. I mean, it costs IOPS, of course, but it gives you safety.
I was wondering when you were saying, "Oh, just put the disks and use the word for disk." I was, "Oh man!"
Yeah, we are pulling the disks, but it's a RAID, so it's rebuilding automatically.
And those problems that you reported there, have you like different tables for them?
There are.
For every single problem, there are two tickets.
The thing is, most of the problems we run into our CloudStack installation. So we opened cases at Accelerite.
Because you have a.
This is supported version, yeah, exactly. Okay. So we did not open, not for everything, but some of them are already been fixed in the actual version.
Okay.
Any other question? Stealing your time? Are we running? Okay, thank you again. Dann lasse ich dich mal hin.
Okay.
Okay.
loopt niet.
Als je het helemaal
afvassen. Wie de bewust.
HDMI one isn't it better?
Nah, we just the DisplayPort here on
this. Yeah. Oh, you don't have
the DisplayPort? No, it's an HDMI.
It's
right.
HDMI.
Yeah. Just DisplayPort. Perfect. Ja, das schon den Stift. Ja, geil. Okay. Let's start. Yeah. Hello and welcome to my talk. It's about our use case. So it's just a use case. It's not a technical deep dive or something like this. So. My name is Sebastian Breitschneider, and I'm working as a Linux system engineer at Bitgroup in Germany. And my main responsibilities are the working with CloudStack, Ansible, Ceph, Linux, and all the other infrastructure related stuff. If you want to contact me later, you can use some of the links. You also can meet me, if you are in Germany, at the user groups of CloudStack German user group or the Ansible user group in Dresden, which is, by the way, organized by my company, which is the Bitgroup. Our main business is the consulting for SAP products, every kind of SAP product. We also do some development for SAP, for example, the cloud platform of SAP, and we do the operations of their data centers. So we are now part of the intelligence group, which is part of NTT Data since last year. Yeah, and at the bottom you have some facts about our company. Okay, the content for this talk is, I will talk about the challenge we had, the environment we got, and then a bit about Ansible with some examples. And two parts we had to develop on our own, and at the end, a picture of all of this together. Okay, first, the challenge we had. So, when we started to develop this cloud platform for our customers, we needed a user interface for our customers. So, the problem is you have a lot of services in your cloud. So, as you know, it's not just CloudStack, you also need backup, monitoring, what else? A lot of services. So you can offer your customers several links to access all these tools, or you create one on your own and implement all these subservices in one user interface. That's what we wanted to have. So the second thing is we wanted to have that all operations you trigger are created by the administrators. So the advantage of this is the developers which develop the user interface don't need to know the complete knowledge about the infrastructure and how services work there and how to trigger something on these services. Then we wanted to have consistent configurations over all systems. Means we see this in other clouds, you deploy systems from templates. So these templates look all the same, but when you come to the point with the application installation is not triggered by a template, it's made by hand. So you end up with little differences between all these systems. In the case of an error, it makes it much harder to resolve this. So we wanted to avoid this. Then we wanted to use as much open source as possible. Then we wanted to have scalability over all these systems we use. We wanted to have a modular design so we can change single parts of our cloud and the customer don't notice. And it should be as simple as possible. That is the challenge we had. So the environment we have now is we use KVM as the hypervisor, Ceph and NFS as storage backends, and we orchestrate this with CloudSec. So as you know, network, storage, compute, all in CloudSec, CloudSec managed. And we have advanced networking setup in CloudSec based on VLANs. And we use shared and isolated networks. The automation is completely done by Ansible. And as I told you, we had to develop something on our own. One is the user interface, we call it portal for the moment. So, and the other part is the Ansible daemon. I will show you later what it's about. So a bit about Ansible. Why did we choose Ansible? We chose it because, at least for me, it's the simplest configuration and deployment tool I know. Because you get it working in a couple of hours. You don't need weeks or months to get it working. Because you have an agentless architecture, means all operations on the clients are done via SSH or WinRM if you are on Windows. And you don't need any programming skills, so because the automation is written in JML, so it's just a markup language, you really don't need any programming skills. And you cannot only deploy systems, you can also configure them, you can deploy applications, whatever you want. That's why we chose Ansible. So Ansible works with modules, and one other reason why we chose Ansible is you have already at the moment 36 modules just for CloudSec. So at all you have around about 1,000 modules where you can trigger stuff on other orchestration platforms or do stuff on Linux, Windows, and you just do this with these modules. So how do we get Ansible working with CloudSec? Of course you have to install Ansible. That's the first step. And the second step is to install the Python CloudSec modules. You can do this with pip or with aptitude. And the second thing you need is a configuration file. called the cloud stack any file. And yeah, you can put it in your home directory, working directory, or provide the location via a variable. And the content of this configuration file you see at the bottom, it's similar to CloudMonkey. If you know CloudMonkey, the configuration file looks pretty the same. You need the endpoint of the API of CloudStack, then an API key and an API secret. That's it. Then you can start working. Then the workflow is pretty simple. You just call the Ansible module. The module is talking to the CloudStack API. CloudStack will do some magic. For example, build up some VMs. And at the end, you can start to configure your created VMs or deploy app on these VMs. That's all. So now, some examples. Ansible work with playbooks. So at the top, you can see a playbook. It runs on localhost, because the way Ansible works is you create tasks, and these tasks are executed on your destination host. So in this case, when we want to do something on CloudStack, we want to call the API, and we do it with this Ansible host. That's because we run it on localhost. And in this example, we just call the role CSVM. And at the bottom, you can see the tasks of this role. So we have three tasks. First, create the VM. Second, add this Ansible or add this new host, which you created to Ansible. So afterwards, we can start to configure this host. And the third part is to roll out the SSH key to this new created VM. And at the bottom, you see a little class, do these steps only when we want to create a VM. And then this creation is done by one Ansible module called CS Instance. And here you see the parameters of this module. Some of them are, of course, mandatory, like the VM name, the template, project zone. And some of them are optional, for example, the hypervisor. So, and at the bottom, you can see we register something in a variable. That's the answer of the CloudStack API. So, for example, we register this in a variable because we want to know the root password of this new created VM, that we can access this VM later. Another example is this port forwarding module, and it works the same way, pretty easy. You have some options you have to set, and that's it. You can find all these options in the Ansible documentation of this module, what you want to use. So as I told you before, we had to develop some stuff on our own. The first is the user interface, of course. Here you can see an example of the Create VM screen. So, and this user interface communicates now with all the services, CloudStack, Ansible, backup, monitoring, and so on, all the services we have. The second part we had to develop on our own was the Ansible daemon. This daemon talks to the user interface, and it does all the playbook handling. For example, it lists you all the playbook, it runs the playbook, it can run just in command. You get an overview over all running jobs or the status of a job when it's running, and you can get some statistics, and you have a scheduler built in, so you can run a task tomorrow, 3 a.m. or you want to run a playbook once a week, you can all do this with this daemon and it talks via REST API to the user interface. When we see this all together, you have the user interface, the portal, and you get all the information what is going on in CloudStack in this portal, because it reads the information from the CloudStack API. And if you want to trigger something, you just trigger the Ansible daemon, and the Ansible daemon will write all the stuff. For example, you will build up a new VM or attach or create a storage to a VM. You trigger the Ansible daemon to trigger an Ansible role, and then it will do these tasks. Or you just deploy an app on your VM, it goes directly to this VM. So where did we end up? We got this user interface with all the services. We have integrated CloudStack, the automation, the backup tool, monitoring, all our services. And we have all write operations in automation. Every stuff which is triggered or changed is done by Ansible. And we, the administrators, are writing the automation, so the developers don't need any knowledge how stuff works there. We have this modular design we wanted, so we can change every single part of our cloud and the customer don't notice. So when we change, for example, the backup system, the customer don't notice this. And we used as much open source as we could. I think only the switches are not open source, all the rest of the software and stuff we use is open source. For example, as a ticket system, we use OTRS, and monitoring is Nagios with CheckMK, the storage, Ceph, CloudStack, all open source. And we have an API for the user, so he can talk directly to this user interface via the API and trigger stuff with their own automation or whatever. And we got the scalability. Some of them came from the application itself, for example, Ceph or CloudStack. And the other scalability, for example, with Ansible. So if you have a big cloud and you have just one Ansible host, you don't have really scalability. So we have in our setup one Ansible host in every customer project. So, and then we get this scalability, the same with LDAP and monitoring. We have this one service machine, and so we spread the workload over all these machines. That's it from my side. Any questions?
The API you're talking about, is that something you created yourselves, or are you wrapping up CloudStack and that?
No, it's built on our own, yeah.
Could it self underline storage, what version of itself are you using?
At the moment, Hammer. But...
Any issues with it?
No, not at all. At first we had some issues. First we used, for example, as the underlying OS, Debian. And we use BTRFS as the file system, and this is not really a good combination. So then we switch.
You mean BTRFS on top of the block device, right?
For the file system on the host.
Yeah.
The OSD's file system was BTRFS. So we changed this now to X4, and the OS is now Ubuntu. And now it works perfectly.
Did you use Ansible Tower or something like that?
No, not open source. And you have to pay for every machine. And we needed this special setup. We wanted to talk to our user interface, and that's why we created this daemon on our own.
So the user interface you create is not directly talking to CloudStack, it's talking to Ansible, and Ansible is talking to CloudStack, that is?
All reading access is done directly from CloudStack, but all writing operations are done by the automation.
And you're using using your versioning tool for keeping track of the changes? For example, changing in a playbook?
Git.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah, when we, as I told you, we have one service machine in every customer project. When we build up this VM, it's done by Ansible, and then one step is to clone a Git repository with all these playbooks. Okay, then, thanks.